Welcome to this edition of the Jolly Heretic. Happy Easter. Happy
Easter. The Lord has risen.
The Lord is risen. He is risen.
Yes. Hallelujah.
Hallelujah. Jesus knows it, call us, Dan. And welcome to the Jolly Heretic. We are, of course, online public house. Meets on Mondays at 7 p.m. UK time, 2 p.m. New York, which discuss based science and stuff going on in the news and all kinds of things that are increasingly expunged from our woke joke universities. So cheers, everybody. Cheers, Paul.
Clapham Massive.
Cheers, Lipton. Cheers, Nina. Hurling Gulligan, Capis, Salu, Saludo, Proust,
Cross. Lachaim.
Yep, Slanger, Slangervar, Hurling Gulligan, whatever I missed out, Skoll, and yes, Hudavond, and Fine Passon, Hudavond, the half Mediawa, Fulton, is there. Key Piss, and welcome to the Jolly Heretic. Cheers, everybody. As usual, it's a dramatic, it's just every week. I was thinking earlier, what would it be like if we were to try, if they had the internet like this in about 1997 or 1996? There wouldn't be much to talk about. There would be nothing happening. But now there is. So this is Dr. Nina Power. Nina, can you introduce yourself?
Oh, sure. I am a doctor. I'm not a useful one. I have a PhD from a million years ago from a university whose department of philosophy is now closed and has been for many years. So I'm infinitely useless. I am a writer. I have a Substack. I don't know. What am I? I'm sort of traitor, betrayer of the left. I have lots of haters. They only make me stronger.
Nina, could I just question you quickly? If you refer to yourself as a useless doctor, that would mean you were able to be a consultant in the NHS. So don't play your qualifications down.
Well, if anyone needs healing from a philosophy PhD, I'm your woman.
It's University of Abuja failed, as is the general qualification of so many doctors these days. Right, I'm in the unusual position among the four of us on this panel, as you all know, chaps, of not living in England, and I took the view, or Britain, and I took the view 21 years ago that it was turning into a police state and it was time to leave, and I did. And although I earned shit money for years and years and years, I don't exactly regret it because of what has happened, what has been announced today by Andrew Bridgen, formerly a Conservative Member of Parliament somewhere in Leicestershire, I believe, which is that he was interviewed under caution a week ago or so for retweeting of the Amelia AI-generated video. You know the one I mean, chaps? The one where she says, oh, this is what I like, this is what I don't like, and she, well, that has a go at Keir Starmer and has a go at Muslim grooming gangs and whatever. And he retweeted that in January, as did I, and it never occurred to me in a million years that there could be anything illegal about it. And he was interviewed under caution and no further action is taken based on an anonymous complaint. I'm just trying to get my head around to what extent this is just, is this just East Germany in the 80s or what? So I will start with our guest, Nina. Nina, what did you think about this?
Well, I mean, the Labour government keeps saying that they're going to stop doing these non-crime hate incidents and they're going to stop harassing people for tweets and so on, but they clearly aren't. They keep doing it. I mean, I think obviously one way of governing a people is through confusion and chaos and random arrests, right? Like, it also saves on manpower. You don't have to arrest everyone. You can just arrest a few high profile people. And one of the things that our legal system unfortunately does is allow for anonymous accusations where the person then arrested or questioned isn't told who has complained or often even the nature of the complaint. Right. It's simply like, oh, you've done something bad and we're going to question you. We're going to shake you up. I have to say, I admire people like Sam Melia, who was obviously in prison for stickers. I think you interviewed him, Ed. And he has not been cowed at all. Like, he just seems like, I was right. Every time I asked a question about what I was in for, they couldn't answer me. And, this is ridiculous, right? So I think there's a sense in which Everybody knows that these arrests and these things are completely silly. I mean, the idea of being questioned under caution for retweeting a meme that was very funny, which was actually based on government-owned propaganda. Amelia, of course, was a sort of a silly art ho who was constructed in order to sort of highlight, you know, the danger of far-right ideology and the corruption of young men through the dyed-haired girl. But obviously she became reclaimed as this kind of very funny and charming figure of the right. Also reclaiming hair dye and chokers in the process away from the left. And yeah, you know, so I mean, I think a lot of people have gone through a version of this experience, like being questioned, being arrested, being named in potent or hate reports, going through court cases. I know I have. You know, it's I think the more people experience a version of this, the easier it is to take. But of course, it's not great if the police are coming to your house, frightening your family, bashing your door at 3 a.m. or, you know, people are being accused and defamed left, right and centre, left. I mean, I think something like the Hope Not Hate report really reveals this sort of, how do I put it? It's almost like a badge of honour to be named in the Hope Not Hate report, right?
Yeah, but you're not in it then, Nina, are you?
You know what? I'm really not, because I just started working for the New Culture Forum, who do have an entry in the this year's report, but I think I joined just slightly too late. I know very well for a fact that at least one person has been trying to get Hope Not Hate to list me in there, put me in their report. They have tweeted against me at one point, but no, I'm apparently just not meaningful enough,
not based enough. It's insane, Paul. What were your thoughts on this Andrew Bridgen thing?
Well, I'll just very quickly say that I think you've done your bit, Ed, for hair dye and chokers. You wear a cravat, not a choker. But you ladle on the hair dye, so you're our right wing Amelia. So well done, you.
I don't dye my hair, but
yeah, of course you don't. You don't.
I can't. Some
there
of us
is free speech in the UK as well, Ed. Are we just trading bollocks now?
Oh, some of us. Okay, bother to maintain our hair color. You know,
how can you do that?
How can you maintain? You've just given yourself away, you tosser.
Do you want to see my chest hair? That's good.
No.
You dye your chest. So what?
I dye my chest. What? Sorry, what, Luton?
I know Nina Poward from Compact Magazine.
Yes. I used to work for them. That's right.
Yeah, I remember your story now better. Yes, I remember what happened to you. You were dumped. I was trying to remember where I know Nina from.
Yeah. Yeah. Are we going offline?
Go on. The problem, I'm just going to say quickly, the problem is even fairly sort of based and sensible organizations and publications panic when you're being kind of mobbed or stalked by insane people, which is what periodically has happened to me multiple times since 2018. and so they kind of panicked and I resigned. So, yeah.
But Nina, I think you're being incredibly unfair to the police, because if they don't bring in people like Andrew Bridgen for, you know, terrible dissemination of awful memes and stuff, they'd actually have to go out and stop people knifing people. They'd have to stop shoplifting. And, you know, when you're overweight and you're a woman who's 5 foot tall who goes to demonstrations with a baton and does nothing with it, I think these are just unreasonable expectations for the modern British police force.
Yeah, you're quite right.
In the actual video, actually, it has a scene where this guy in the countryside gets arrested for, you've tweeted rudely and you're under arrest. That's actually in the video. and then Andrew Bridgen has retweeted rudely. I mean, it's...
Can't you envisage a scenario, though, where somewhere like the Free Speech Union gets, you know, millions of pounds of a donation from some incredibly rich philanthropist, and they just start counter-prosecuting the police for malicious prosecution? Something like that needs to happen. The police can't keep getting away with it.
Yes, I don't see how it is anything other than malicious prosecution. All I can conceive of is that it would be somebody... some anonymous weirdo that makes the complaint, or it could even be someone quite high up that wants to intimidate this guy. What's going on? You're getting a fax, Nina.
Sorry, I've just got to answer the door. I'll be back.
It sounds like a fax machine. I didn't know people had fax machines anymore. I think that it needs to be. It's that the police should be prosecuted for like wasting their own time.
Misconduct in public office or malicious prosecution, anything you know that would stick.
If they interview somebody under court, if it doesn't lead to a prosecution, then the police should be prosecuted for wasting their own time. I think then they would have the sense to realise you can't do that. It's the process being the punishment. It's what you do in a police state. Some woke police officer probably thought, you know, let's just annoy this guy, upset this guy, intimidate this guy for a week and a half because we can. Lipton.
No, I was about to say that I think, as Paul suggested some months ago...
Pausing.
I'm not pausing. I'm saying Paul suggested months ago that a billionaire should destroy these left-wing organizations with lawfare, and I agree with him.
Yeah, well,
from the Southern Poverty Law Center to Hope Not Eat, all of them.
Yeah, Paul Hawkins, 6415, is saying that he's suing them, apparently. And thank goodness Nina has not been arrested. She has not been arrested. This is good. I was slightly concerned that was the police, and that you'd said something on the stream, which was an arrestable offence.
I think it could have been the security services associated with Grecian 2000 because they've outed you, Ed.
I don't know why I get this. If I was going to dye my hair, I wouldn't have white bits here. So I mean, it's
bluff.
The jealousy of the prematurely grey man, Paul.
Very
prematurely. Nick Griffin has a full head of brown hair, and he's 66. So I was amazed by that when I met him.
Ed, it must be a sign of high testosterone or something, don't you think? You would know.
It must be. My dad's the same though. My dad's how old's my dad? 73, and he's 72, and he's bald, but he's got no grey hair.
Right. My father's a bit like that. Actually,
I can see how that works.
Don't bald men have more testosterone?
I believe they do, yes. Well, there's some evidence. I don't know how big the effect size is, but
apparently... Could I just ask a silly question? How could they have grey hair if they're bald?
Well, let's be pedantic. It's not like that guy from Thunderbirds.
So he's not fully bald, then, is he?
No, he's got hair around here.
He's tonsured.
Okay, fine. He's tonsured. My father is a monk. I was actually at university with a chap whose father did literally used to be a monk. And then he went to Oxford and did a PhD or something and met some bird and then stopped being a monk and ended up having two kids. So there you go. Right. But it is a side. I don't like coming back to the UK because I just think to myself that this is so unfree. And the kind of people that enforce the law are so stupid as well.
I think it's the stupidity that hurts the most. I mean, to go back to Clapham Massive's point about what the police are actually up to. I mean, I live in Southwark, which is not a very rich part of... I don't know if you've been to my flat. I don't think you have, Ed. Anyway, I live in a council block in Southwark. And, you know, I look out my window and there's literally a crack house opposite. There are drug dealers in the park. There's loads of gangs. There's loads of people stealing phones all the time. I mean, there's tons of crime. Like, someone ran amok in East Street Market and killed somebody about 2 years ago and injured two other people. Like, there's, I mean, in all seriousness, like, there's absolutely tons of crime the police could be, like, dealing with. And, you know, they'd rather arrest some sort of nicely spoken middle-class politician. Whatever. I mean...
I noticed something interesting, and I'm sorry it's a tangential issue, but I saw Irish footage. It must have been in Dublin, but an Islamist who set fire to the guy who created that Forge Guinness thing, you know, that big celebrity guy in Ireland. But he set fire to his pub, and then he also tried to knife a policeman, and two policemen, Irish policemen, battened him, and you can see the footage. Battened him really violently, and in the process there were two pedestrians trying to stop the police because they took his side. I'm sure they hadn't seen the full, you know, series of events, but even so, the instinct now is to help whoever, you know, could look violent but fits the right demographic.
So the he was so where was the guy from that was violent?
He was an Islamist. So, and this was the other thing. Okay. The media reported it. Leo Kearse put it on his channel, and he was reported as being an Irish citizen, born in Ireland. Blah blah blah. And Leo Kearse was pointing out, well, yeah, he had an Irish passport, but culturally, he certainly wasn't Irish. He was trying to stab two Garda, and just pointing out the passers-by tried to help him. It's just.
The degree, I was talking earlier to a guy called Martin Selmer, the interview will come out anon, and I was making, but the degree to which it's that guy, that indoctrinated guy that, you know, if you're watching, hello, that I ran into in Luton, that came up to me knowing that I was interviewing people about base things and saying, no, it's all the diversity, it's great. It's like that guy that was in... what's his name, in the film on GB News, and he was saying, oh, yeah, it hasn't changed much and everything's great. And then a woman in a burqa walks past in the background. And he continues, like the Shire horse or whatever he's called in Animal Farm. It's just like, I'm a boxer. I must work harder. I daren't see or allow myself to think about what I'm seeing before my own eyes. And there's so many people that are like that, that they just want to feel that they're good people. The way that you feel that you're good is by... signaling that we love multiculturalism, it's joyful and wonderful, and I love the diversity and all the takeaway food, and they can't allow themselves to be annoyed by it or to be hurt by it, and I don't know how you deal with that.
I've been thinking about this a lot, Ed, and I mean, the psychology, because it's like if one domino falls, the whole lot falls, so the whole edifice has to sort of be maintained in this sort of, I don't know, delusional thing. I mean, it must be partly a question of status. Like, it's very hard to get, if everybody's saying the same thing, your job depends upon it, your friendship group depends upon it, your own feeling of being a good person. Like, if the only morality you have is like this weird post-Christian, unforgiving, progressive thing, like that's all you have, right? So the psychological pain, the suffering it will cause to give up on, I don't know, anything from transgenderism to climate change to... immigration to whatever, to crime, to anything, is like it will cause you too much pain and possibly material and social suffering, right? And I think most people in every regime, whatever it is, are conformist, right? Most people want an easy life. They don't want to risk their job. They want to support their family. Some of these are good things, right? But if the ideas are really bad and the regime is really bad, you're going along with evil. You know, then it's not great. But I think we're, you know, the majority is being manipulated by an ideology pushed by a minority, right, who've really got sort of very malign intentions. But most people are just going along with it. And then a few weird people who are like, care more about truth than they do about their own social standing will say, no, actually, this isn't true, or this is what's happening. The noticers, right, the, you know, whatever we want to call them.
Or I suppose they don't necessarily. They could. It could be that if you are a dissident, then this will turbocharge your sense of identity, and you will be noticed, and people will pay attention to you, even if it's in a negative or frightened way. They'll see you maybe as frightening, which gives you a kind of power, and that may incentivize some people, perhaps.
Maybe. I don't know. As someone who's kind of hated by a lot of people, it's not that empowering. I mean, I sort of find it funny in a way. And I do pray for my enemies as a good Christian. I love my enemies. But, I mean, they're not my enemies, but I'm theirs.
I love you, Ed.
I love you, Triple.
You know, God is love. But, I don't know. It doesn't give me that much power. I mean, I get accused of being, you know, a neo-Nazi, whatever, fascist. But like, if they were really scared of me, I don't think they'd be doing that, because they'd be thinking that I was really, you know, had the power to ruin their lives or beat them up. But they obviously don't think that. They just think we can say what we like about her and other people.
Yeah, but then you with regard to what you were talking about, you were on the left, weren't you?
Yeah.
A bit. Or you were, it's a fact. And then you're not. So you took the kick to your status or your friendship groups or whatever. I mean, did you lose friends?
Oh, almost all of them. Yeah, at that time. Yeah. I mean, I was very involved in, like, defend the right to protest. I mean, the thing is, it's like I'm a 90s leftist, right? So I'm into transgressive art, freedom of expression, you know, that kind of leftist, and, like, maybe a bit of redistribution or something, but, like, having a good time and forgiving people and being kind. And then whatever the left is now is not that. And basically, I couldn't go along with the lie in the first place that human beings could change sex, which is by now a classic reason to be cancelled. So I said something on Facebook. I mean, it's so stupid. I, you know, that, like, people can't change sex and this was unfair to women and children. And then I got insane activists. People have thrown coffee at me. I've had to give talks with police, security guards protecting me. I mean, it's like completely mental. I didn't know how mad the activists were, but some of them are really crazy. Yeah.
Well, Lipton.
Exactly. Ed is such a hog. He wants to talk all the time. He doesn't want me to get a seat.
I agree, Lipton. Let's not hear what I said. Lipton.
Lipton, he tells me off camera he's going to do it. I think it's reprehensible. Stop it, Ed.
No, so I'm talking to Nina. So, Nina, you're a smart woman, so you should appreciate this reality that women who support the trans movement hate themselves. Perfect example. Some time ago, a company had an event for women and men showed up saying that they are non-binary. Gender quotas also benefit trans women who are men. So I find it so strange that there are women who have become enablers of this ideology because it does not benefit women. Furthermore, yeah. What's even more disturbing is that we now have several studies, piles of studies, showing that the effects of transitioning are negative, especially the medications, they're negative. Some of the medications can even lower IQ, permanently lower IQ. Yes.
Oh, yeah, no. I mean, the whole thing is based on a lie. You can't change sex, and all of the treatments are terrible, and lying to children is particularly egregious. And, you know, medication and surgery, just horrific. I mean, the interesting question from what you said, from my point of view, is, like, why do so many women go along with transgenderism? I have thought about this quite a lot. There are obviously some very high-profile feminists and men who speak out against it, right, and are punished for doing so. J.K. Rowling would be the obvious one, but Kelly J. Keene and many others. But I think, I mean, see what Ed thinks about this. It's like, you know, the women obviously don't have, like, physical power, right? So their power is kind of social and reputational and verbal. And perhaps there's a sense in which women are, like, either naturally and or kind of culturally trained to be kind in a certain way, which often means, like, pretending things aren't happening or go along with stuff in order to pretend that there's social harmony. So I don't know if there's a really good explanation for why a lot of women go along with transgenderism, especially as Lipton, you say correctly, it's directly opposed to women's interest, right? It's not in women's interest to support this in a number of ways. So I think we have to ask the question, like, why do so many women?
It's in their interests. I mean, a lady I've had, an academic I've had on this on the Jolly Heritage called Danny Sulkowski, made this point. It's in their interests to come across to other women as extremely nice.
Why?
Because that's the currency in female psychology. You get a small number of women who are your friends, who you have a close relationship with, who are kind of allo parents or potential allo parents for your children. That's how the friendships operate in evolutionary terms. Mm-hmm. And so you want a woman to be super nice because you're potentially trusting her with your offspring. So you then signal niceness and kindness. And the worst thing is to be accused of being mean. And it's you know, stereotypically this word that women will use against men, and men are like, what are you talking about? I'm just telling the truth. Yeah. So it's the idea is to come across as super nice to the extent that I think that this is argued a book, I don't know if you've read it, Nina, called Warriors and Warriors by Joyce Benson. Yeah. It's very good. And she notes that women will are unconsciously ambitious. They're trying to get the top man they can get or the job or whatever, but they can be so self-deluded that they won't even realize that they're doing it until then they've done it and they've got the top guy and whatever. So I think that's why it's so important among women that the queen bee is to be bullied and until she gets an eating disorder and tries to commit suicide. That's what Daddy said to me. And she did a very interesting paper, Nina, where she said that women will rate another woman as in their league, you know, in terms of sexiness out of 10. And so they're competing for the same men they're competing for. And then women will persuade women that are in their league to cut their hair short. And they'll tell them, I do love your haircut. Oh, it looks so good short. And it doesn't. It never does, at least not if they're young. It never does. And that's a deliberate tactic to remove competition. And she did a paper on this.
I quite like the gay mind look.
The what look?
The gay mind, when you have like a little elfin short haired look.
Oh, gamine.
Gamine or gay mind, tomato, tomato.
Well, no, because I don't think Americans pronounce it gay mine. But the point is that that's how they operate. And so you can see how you're so nice, you're so kind that you want to accept these trans women.
Trans women are considered to be an oppressed group. And we're living in the era of the oppression Olympics. So if you are from an oppressed group, your status is automatically elevated. That's why people like Ibram Kendi can get away with writing crap.
Yeah.
But there is a certain vaguely humorous irony that the transgender thing ultimately, when you reduce it to its essentials, are men pretending to be women, telling women what to do. So at a certain level, when it's men telling women what to do,
well, I think there are big parallels between transgenderism and Islam, to be honest. There's like a kind of horseshoe.
Yeah, don't go down the controversial route, Nina, whatever you do.
No, don't bother. We're not trying to be controversial on here, Nina. Sorry, explain. How is there a parallel between transgenderism and Islam?
Can I go and hide first?
Well, you know, it's a very straightforward way. It's like men telling women what to do and what they are.
See.
And what women are, right? Look, the entire point of feminism, the good bit, I'm going to defend some of the second wave, was to say, look, women exist and it's up to them to decide what they do with their lives and who they are. You know, it's not like being... Ed is like...
No, Ed's just getting aroused, Nina. That's his aroused phase.
It's such a preposterous idea that they should just decide their own lives. That goes against all evolutionary dynamics. But carry on, Nina.
Look, the cat is out of the bag. What are you going to do? Look, there is a serious question here, which I want to put to all of you, right? Britain, right, this current police state, crime-riddled, you know, hellhole run by insane, awful people who are trying to kill us all.
Stop talking it up, Nina.
but like, at the same time, it's the most beautiful country in the world, and everything that we love is still here. We just need to restore it.
Ed's not.
Shut up. but look, Britain is a pagan country, a Christian country, and a liberal country. And my feeling is that we actually need to defend the current historical state where we got to, which was a kind of liberal individualism. You know, some people are Christian and da da da, and we all inherit those Christian values. You know, maybe they're watered down and we've gotten rid of God, but you know, essentially we're sort of a Christian country. But we need to defend like where we got to, like in the 90s, let's say, just using that as a kind of snapshot, and say, well, actually, look, our women are free to walk around the streets without wearing headdress. They are allowed to walk around on their own. They are allowed to own property and all of those sorts of things. Do you know what I mean? Like, we got to that point and vote and stuff. And I realised that, like, one of the issues I have is that some men on the right are basically agreeing with the kind of anti-woman position that you get in Islam. You know, so that, again, there's another horseshoe there, isn't there? Right? And I think we need to, at least strategically, defend the liberal values that we have been born into in this country. against the forces of reaction. And that might be annoying because it will mean like listening to shrewish, you know, squeaky women like me, but you invite me on your show, so, you know.
No, but you're not a normal woman, though, are you? As we've had this discussion before, you have like kind of the brain of a man.
Ed, I told you the todger doesn't show. Stop it.
No, she's definitely...
Show some discretion. I'm a gentleman.
No, I've met her husband. She's definitely a woman. But that's what I mean. It's the average and it's the outliers, and that's the problem. So when you talk about women voting, great. Well, what do the women vote? Overwhelmingly, they reinforce whatever the dogma is at the time. That's what they vote. So if you go back to the generation born in the 20s, which was a highly conservative society at that point, then women were much more conservative than men, much more likely to vote for the right, and now they're much more likely to vote for the left.
Okay. Well, we need strong men for women to want to have, you know, like I think the order of leadership, right? If you want to, this is a patriarchal point I'm making, right? You need, if you want to make conservatism high status among women, right? There'll have to be some mimetic role models who are female, who are like, oh, I don't know, like Sydney Sweeney or something. I mean, Lana Del Rey. I mean, you know, there are some women who at least are sort of right coded in this terrible vibe economy, which is apparently what politics is now, is vibes. We never used to use this word. I hate this word, vibes. Anyway, I think you're also going to have to make like strong men attractive again. We've also got like enormous numbers of weak men. Like, why aren't the men standing up to the men who are pretending to be women, for example? Like, where are the men? There are some who do it, but like,
well, yeah, Nina, but to be fair, they're not in our changing rooms.
Well, yeah, but then you're,
like, no, well, that's one practical reason. I can't kick a tranny in the nuts if they're not in my changing room. I'd have to go into the women's changing room and I'd get arrested.
It makes a good point. And also, I think the thing is that as society feminizes, Nina, it feminizes the men. And you get, you know, kind of Adam Rutherford types.
But is this men's fault or women's fault? Right? But men have allowed society to become feminized, right?
So they kind of have.
I agree with you, Nina. Men should set the standard and allow women to follow. They should stop leading from behind. They are weak men, unlike myself.
Well, no, but then we men gave women the right to, basically women that basically had borderline personality disorder manipulated men through, you know, refusing to eat and trying to kill themselves and literally killing themselves in one case, and blowing up post boxes and smashing windows.
Is this a history of your exes?
No, you said about the early feminists.
I'm talking about the women's, the WSPU.
Okay, back on track. Thank you.
Good. It's a history of some of my exes, I guess I should confess. And they did all that and blew up policemen and God knows what. And so then eventually after in the country was wrecked, World War One, and we just gave in and gave them the vote. First of all, we started off by saying, well, you've got to be 30 and whatever it was, there's a restriction. And then you just give them all the vote, and then it's going to fundamentally change things. It's a difficult issue. But we've feminized society, haven't we? I mean, I think we can agree that we have done that. That's why we're so concerned about feelings and offence.
Yeah, I think we tried that, and I think it's awful, and we should not do that anymore.
No, but then you're, as I said, it's...
Can I give a specific example, Nina? You might know, you will know more about this than me. But Suzanne Moore, for example, the journalist, she writes in that she got hounded out of The Guardian for believing in biology. She writes for The Telegraph. And I hear everything you're saying, and I agree with quite a bit of it. But then again, someone like Suzanne Moore, I'm pretty sure if I went back and had the energy, I could find a whole screed of her articles being quite misandrist and anti-men in the past. And guess who gives her refuge? Guess who gives her a voice again? It's the right-wing part of the media. And maybe she's grateful, I don't know. But I get the sense that there's this... We went so far, and now we've realised, oops, we've made a bit of a mistake.
Yeah, well, if you read my great book published by Penguin, somewhat surprisingly, despite much contestation and attempts to not get it published, What Do Men Want? This is actually a book in defense of men and the relationship between men and women in the wake of all of the kind of toxic masculinity and attacks on men, which are still going on. But yeah, I don't disagree that there is a misandrist strain among sort of some elite women. I don't know if it's competition. It's like competition that's spilled over. I think the play of the sexes is a beautiful thing. It's like a dance, you know, it should involve flirtation. But the problem is now you get like a shot in the head if you flirt with someone at work or whatever, you know, HR will come down and
which
you
is know. Female, which is women with sociology degrees, isn't it? That's what HR is.
Well, I don't know. I mean, what do we do? I look, I agree with you. I mean, these women are like terrifying and they're not.
I've adopted the Vic Reeves, you know, on his program where he leans in, rubs his thighs.
I remember that.
Yeah, I think that's a very good flirting technique. Served me well.
I do think serves you well because Paul has a number of women in his cellar locked
basement.
In. Basement that he
it's furnished, Ed, so I don't think strictly speaking it's a cellar.
Okay, yeah, fine, that's an oubliette. I'm beginning to think that I've done a video on this that I put out at some point, that the 1990s may have been the absolute high point, the balance where you still had a generation alive, my grandparents, whatever, Nina's grandparents, that were that age, you know, that have suffered, that have seriously suffered. And then you had people like Paul that were just from Liverpool, so obviously they've suffered. You know, outdoor loos. Oh, you are a mucky kid, dirty as a dustbin lid when he hears the things that you did, and so forth.
Cilla Black wasn't Welsh, by the way, Nina.
He always does that. No, she was from Liverpool. Yeah, the balance was right. And there was, as you say, Nina, there was people were happy and content. And the war was finally over. The war didn't end in 1945, it ended in 1991. And there was this period where there was peace and it was the end of history, which was utter decadence, but unfortunately that's what spawned. But that's how people felt. And women, surely, I mean, yeah, they could get where they wanted to get, but you still didn't have them running everything. I mean, you didn't have, for example, a woman Archbishop of Canterbury.
No.
You didn't have a black woman bishop saying "Habemus Mamma," which is insane and blasphemous and awful. And you didn't have it hadn't gone crazy, and now it's gone crazy. And all we think about is the female values offence. Your tweet has offended people. Whereas in the night we had a phrase at school: "Sticks and stones may break your bones," you know. Yeah. And that's like a microaggression to say that. And I think it's female influence that's done that. But then now I think about it, as a person who was had cerebral palsy and whatever, I would have had a much easier time at school had I been around now. Like I'd have been born in the year 2000. I'd have had all kinds of privileges and, you know, things, and it would have been undoubtedly it would have been easier.
It would have been unbelievably insufferable, Ed. I mean, even more insufferable.
More.
Oh, you pair of cunts. But anyway, sorry, carry on.
Well, I mean, it's so weird to me to think back to the 90s and be like, you know, miserable teenager listening to like Pearl Jam and Nirvana and think, and now think, well, that was the best it ever was. Do you know what I mean? It's like I was bored and melancholic. But that was the best. That was it.
It was. I was Daria. I was a male Daria. Do you remember Daria?
Yeah.
I was like that. I was atheist. I was cynical. I was at a Catholic school. So how do you rebel other than be an atheist?
I was busy buying Barry White albums.
I don't know who that is, but okay.
Barry White.
Why were you buying Barry White records in the 90s?
Can you, Nina, explain to Ed who Barry White was? I think he's talking about being blasphemous, not pretending you don't know who he is. Racist.
Is he the guy that did the voice of Chef in South Park?
No, that's what's his name?
Isaac Hayes.
Barry White was a huge black guy with an amazing voice.
who sang like sultry songs about.
We're gonna
like,
take the receiver off the phone. We're gonna make love like it's supposed to be done.
Let the music play. I'm gonna dance the night away.
Steady on.
Sorry,
I've just had a stroke.
Well, don't stroke yourself live.
Are we supposed to be talking about the Queen or something?
We were going to do that, but we got moved off.
You distracted us, Nina.
It's something that happens on this show. We'll talk about it in the second half. We will talk about the Queen, Charlie. If you've tuned in for Queenie, all 1,000 of you, then we'll talk about Queenie in the second half. But now we're on Barry White. Apparently, Barry White was the walrus of love, says Tommy 502.
Yeah.
And I should listen to this guy. Was he?
Oh, sort of, seriously? How many children were conceived listening to him?
Was that much of a delicious?
The Love Unlimited Orchestra.
That much of a delicious voice. Okay.
Oh, amazing.
All right. Okay, well, I'll just go into the middle spiel. So we're about halfway through. So to those of you new, hello, and welcome to the Jolly Heretic. We are, of course, online public house. It's on Mondays at 7 p.m. UK time, 2 p.m. New York, in which we discuss space science and stuff that's increasingly expanded from our woke joke universities and talk about the news. And yes, it was way off topic, wasn't it? But I'm very sorry. Like, it's Lipton's fault. Woke joke universities. If you are new, well, 527 watching on YouTube, I assume, sir, but there's another 500 watching on Twitter. If you are new, will you please subscribe? Could you subscribe on YouTube and leave a like for the algorithm and a comment for the algorithm and all that kind of stuff? And could you subscribe to my Substack? That's jollyheretic.com, where I put all the most base science I don't put on YouTube, in-person interviews, vlogs, including with Nina, vlogs, frogs. Where if you like what I do, you can support with the cost of a pint of beer a month. Next to me, we have Clapham Massive. We should talk about that as well. Clapham Massive, Dr. Paul Taylor, formerly of Leeds University, lecturer in communications. So could you please subscribe to his channel? Again, link in description. Readers of the Lost Art, where he does a wry and grumpy and misanthropic sort of Edmund from King Lear kind of look.
Borderline suicidal inducing.
Yeah, borderline suicidal. God, stand up for bastards. A look at art and books and literature and that. Now we have Mr. Lipton Matthews. Again, link in description. Please subscribe to Lipton's channel. He gets all kinds of interesting interviewees on his channel because he's black and he has black privilege, a concept which he invented, which almost got me thrown out of a pub once in Swindon because it offended.
I'm going to publish a book, Nina.
Yeah, I've been reading his book and I've been telling him to make it more fun. It's very good. It's very clear and whatever, but it does feel like it's been written by Richard Lynn.
There are no limericks. Exactly. You need limericks, Lipton. You need the resident poet to write you a limerick at the beginning of every chapter.
It's a very dry style, Lipton. You need to sex it up. Okay. And then I will write a foreword for it. And then finally, we have Dr. Nina Power, who is also a recovering academic, a former lecturer in philosophy at the University of Senior Lecturer in Philosophy or something, I think it was, at the University of Roehampton. Which is just down the road from where my parents live. She has a Substack, so just put Nina Power, and that's Substack, and she has various books. I should plug my new book, shouldn't I?
Nina, my book is about Africa.
Oh, wow. In what, like historically?
Historically and contemporary.
Okay, cool.
So I'll talk about my new book. So please buy my new brilliant book, The Quaker Question, Exposing the Sect That Really Rules the World.
Do they really rule the world? Anyway, whatever.
Well, they don't, but they do a bit. Right, yeah. Put another head out. Yes. So, good. Excellent. So we're moving into the second half, so we should probably get on topic. So I read an interesting article in The Telegraph, which is what inspired this. I think it was by somebody called some name like Sophie Money Coots or some absurd name. And she made the good point that basically she's been dead for quite a while. Can we finally objectively discuss the Queen? And a chap I know called Sean Gabb christened her many years ago. You know Sean Gabb, Lipton?
Yeah, I know Sean Gabb. Not personally, but I read his blog, The Libertarian Alliance.
Yeah, writer of some good books. And he said she should be called Elizabeth the Useless. because she presided over the collapse of the British Empire and then the Empire Strikes Back and basically did absolutely nothing. And surely, considering she has presided over essentially the invasion of her country, she's broken her coronation oath. She's just abominable. That's basically his view. And I wonder if it's time to actually discuss this, because she's particularly over the last 30 years, she was law after law by New Labour and whatever, making this into a police state. She had, in theory, the right to do something about it. And she just did bugger all. I'll start with Nina. Nina, what do you think about Queenie?
Well, Queen Elizabeth I was quite badass, but that was ages ago. I do think there's something quite interesting about England insofar as it's had a number of like really quite cool women over the course of our history, and there's something kind of maritime and female about England.
Have you got to that chapter in my book yet where I look at our queens?
Oh, in the BPD book?
Yeah.
No, I haven't. I'm reading, for people who are listening, I'm reading a draft of Ed's new book, because apparently he writes a book every 6 weeks.
Yes.
which is on the relationship between BPD women and powerful men, or sort of narcissistic men and BPD women.
And he ordered you to read it.
Yeah, well, I've discussed personality disorders with Ed on his show before. It's a very interesting topic. Anyway, but the Queen, it's difficult, isn't it? Because I thought when she died, I thought, well, she did her duty. Like, this here is someone who played her role and she did it really well. But obviously all the things you're saying are correct as well. Like, I think there's a sort of strange thing sometimes you get with Americans on social media where they sort of think that the monarchy has all this power. Like, why isn't the king stepping in or whatever, into the immigration or Islam question or whatever. But it's very hard to understand how much power they do have. They have enormous symbolic power. And in that sense, they have reneged on their duty to the country and to the British people. And the Queen, in this sense, could have defended Britain more, right? She could have said, we're a Christian country. We have these traditions. We have these people and so on and so forth. But she obviously sort of didn't say anything about anything, really. And that was her vibe.
That was her coronation oath. Her coronation oath was very specifically to defend the Church of England, the Reformed Church of England, and she didn't. And to defend her own people. And I can't see how she did. If she was signing into law restrictions on freedom of expression, restrictions on freedom of association, and just every law, every appalling law that's been passed since the 2nd of May 1997. And she just sat there, did it.
Yep.
So, Lipton, she was your queen as well.
No, I was a fan of the Queen. I really admire the Queen of England. She invested in a role. She took her role seriously. But unfortunately, the Queen was apolitical. That's how I describe her. And nothing is wrong being apolitical, especially when you're in that role. But her apolitical personality was a bit excessive. So this was somebody who would never criticize any policy, any at all. She didn't take serious stances. And because of that, today we're seeing the implication. As Queen, she had some power. And as Sean Gyab rightly said, she presided over what we would now call the wokeification of England.
Yeah, and she did absolutely bugger all. And she could have done. I mean, for example, when it was revealed that almost all members of Parliament were corrupt in 2009, was it? Almost all members of Parliament were corrupt. I would have thought that she could have. I think she would have had the people's support to just dismiss Parliament.
But Ed, wouldn't you say that in Catholic parlance, given it's Easter Monday, there are sins of commission and sins of omission? She was guilty, perhaps, of sins of omission. But King Charles, it's a bit arse about elbow. Why are you talking about a dead lady when you could be talking about the king who's currently alive, who's reinforcing wokeism and arguably is our first non-Christian king?
Yes, I was going to move on to that once I dealt with Queenie.
All right, absolutely. We got rid of the necrophilia. Now we'll do with the real.
All right, we've got rid of the necrophilia. We've done the Jimmy Savile stuff. So, all right, let's. I mean, she was useless and apparently, by all accounts, a horrible person. did you hear the story? David Starkey told me this story that he was at some event in Greenwich, and she arrived to open something or whatever, and she arrived at some in her room, and she said that there appears to be a lavatory in this room, and she said she was late. She was like 45 minutes late. Yes, ma'am. We thought you might like a lavatory in your room. Yes, we would like a gin and bonnet. I'm afraid, ma'am, that we do not have the ingredients in the building. Well, we would be grateful if the ingredients were found. And then somebody was sent off into Greenwich to find gin. Gin's fair enough, but also bonnet, which is bloody hard to find. And then, once she'd had her gin and bonnet, she was prepared to actually do her job, for which she's handsomely paid.
I think that's what kings and queens do. It's in the job description. Be demanding.
That's okay.
Yeah. I'm all with her on that one.
All those times that the Queen Mother was hospitalised because she swallowed a fishbone. No, she was allergic to lobster, but she couldn't help but eat lobster because she liked it so much. And it was felt that shouldn't be reported in the press, because it sounded elitist. So then they just say, "Oh, she swallowed a fishbone." No, she was having an allergic reaction to lobster.
These aren't crimes against humanity, Ed.
What?
I liked her, the Queen's mother. I really do.
The Queen Mother, God bless her. The Queen Mum.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
She was based. I mean, she was.
So,
exactly. The Meghan Markle. I would have loved to have her around in the Meghan Markle.
What I don't like about Meghan Markle is she's putting out pictures of the back of her children's heads today.
Ed, can we go back a bit? You're basically accusing the Queen Mother of mainlining lobster, and this is somehow the worst thing in the world.
No. But let's move on to Charles. So, I'm sorry, what is the evidence? Because people keep talking about this. What is the evidence that he's actually converted to Islam? Because that's what people keep
saying. Well, he's converted, but he seems very Islamist adjacent.
Well, there is. He one of his intellectual mentors, I mean, he's very influenced by perennialism, right? Which is a kind of way of looking at all world religions and thinking that they're all aiming at the same truth through different means and that kind of thing. He's also very influenced by Laurens van der Post and sort of René Grenon and various thinkers.
Who's that guy with the hook, Nina?
What?
Abu Hamza.
Yeah, I think he's influenced him as well.
I think you're just being silly now. I was trying to make a serious historical point. but I think he probably has a kind of a theoretical view of Islam. I mean, the more cynical position would be something like, well, he and William and everyone is just preparing for the inevitable demographic takeover. And, you know, Islam is playing kingmaker in the political sense, which is why the Greens and Labour are fighting over them. And, you know, so maybe they're just kind of completely cynical. Maybe he did convert. Some people say he's Jewish and that he was circumcised by a rabbi at some point. I mean, people make all kinds of claims. I mean, there's obviously...
Sorry, Nina, I've forgotten the poem. Tonight we discuss with Miss Power, was Elizabeth's legacy sour? Her insuperable reign may well have caused pain. Let's hope we're not sent to the tower. Thank you very much, Mr. Quinn. I thought that was a bit silly, though.
You read that so quickly, I didn't hear it. Can you read it again, please, slowly?
Because it's about you and you want to hear it. Yeah, I understand.
Yes,
Okay, where was I? Sorry. Tonight we discuss with Miss Power, was Elizabeth's legacy sour? Her insuperable reign may well have caused pain. Let's hope we're not sent to the tower. Thank you very much, Mr. Quinn, and sorry for forgetting the poem. And if you like that, which you should, then you can buy Mr. Quinn's book of Jolly Heretic Poetry on Amazon. Sorry, Nina, carry on. So Charles, sympathies with perennialism.
Well, okay, so I think he has an intellectual sympathy, kind of, you know, this perennialist philosophy. He's written a book called Harmony. I mean, he's like a sort of posh hippie. There is that photograph of him wearing the sort of Islamic dress. Okay, maybe this was just being polite. Clearly, Catherine got told off the other day for crossing her legs in a mosque. There was footage of that. There does seem to be a lot of deference going on to Islam. There, obviously, the message, he didn't put out a message for Easter, but he did for Ramadan or something. Well, it's not looking good, is it? I mean, I don't know if he's secretly Muslim, but maybe.
He's reverted.
He's not a very good king. I had higher hopes, to be honest. But do you think William would be will be any good. William, I mean, William and Catherine are at least sort of nice couple. Like, she's really quite lovely, isn't she?
To put up with what he's done, yes, yes, she is.
And what do you mean? Not
allowed, oh, come on.
I'm not a royal gossip. I don't know what's he done.
You've not read my Substack about it. In certain circles, it is widely understood. You know, in the same way that it is widely understood in certain circles, and Andrew Lowney has now gone public with this, which I don't know. I know it's widely discussed because I first was told this when I was an undergraduate at Durham, when there were lots of posh people around, which is that Andrew is, you know, the is not his father's son. I was told this like 25 years ago.
You mean Harry?
No, Andrew.
Okay, because I thought Harry was not thinking.
No, Harry is. No, that's
no. No.
Harry is his father's son.
No. Looks nothing like him. I had this argument with students at the time, Ed, and what was the name of the army guy that Princess Diana...
James Hewitt.
I put a photograph of James Hewitt up on a lecture screen and a photograph of Harry, and half the lecture hall went, oh.
Yeah, but if you look at the teeth, if you look at the teeth.
Oh, God, crass Darwinism, bugger off.
It's not crass Darwinism, it's empirical evidence. If you look at the teeth, right, Prince Harry has these kind of flat teeth that are a sign of being Southern European. He doesn't have pointed gnashers like we normal people have. This is consistent with him having with blood from Southern Europe, which he would have via his father's line, but he wouldn't have it via James Hewitt's line. So I think he is his father's son, whereas I think that Andrew probably isn't. I think you've got a 10-year age gap between they have two kids.
And so you think wait there, you think Harry looks more like Charles than James Hewitt?
No, I can appreciate that there's the ginger element, but that's from his mother's side.
No, the ginger's one element, not the element. It's one element. There's if it looks like a duck, swims on a lake, eats bread, quacks, and has a beak, even you as a crass Darwinist, wouldn't you say that's a duck?
It possibly, though it could be an Egyptian duck, Egyptian goose, sorry, which is actually a kind of duck, which has migrated out of Norfolk, and it's doing havoc to the local wildlife. It's a terrible thing, but anyway, metaphor for something. But I'm pointing out Prince Andrew anyway, and I'm talking about the fact that there was they don't have children for 10 years. Philip had an affair, we know that, and so she has an affair with this Lord Porchester, Earl of Carnarvon, maybe, and produces a son that looks nothing like a father. That's the rumour, or as we say in Finnish, the hoo-hoo, which means rumour. Sorry, we've got off topic though. What were we talking about, Nina?
I was talking about Catherine and, you know, William, right? Lots of people, I mean, Catherine Middleton, as was, you know, now whatever she is, Queen Catherine or something, Princess Catherine, really good on the monarchy thing, and obviously, as you can tell, she's quite beloved, isn't she? She's very well liked, you know, she's sort of a nice girl who married up. She's hypergamous, Ed, surely.
She is hypergamous. Well, that's normally how it works, isn't it? I mean, Nina's husband is a marquis. And this is what they...
That's why I live in a council house in Southwark.
He's the Marquis of Southwark. He's the Marquis of Southwark. And so that's what they...
The Marquis of Chav.
The Marquis of Southwark. That's what they do. That's what women do. They fight.
I have not done that, but none of my boyfriends have been have had any status whatsoever, but that's okay. I think love sometimes is not hypergamous,
but hypogamous, i.e. the opposite of that, i.e. that you marry down.
Ed, can I clarify why you're picking on infidelity as the judgment as to whether members of the royal family are somehow, you know, beyond the pale? Well, why mention it though? As far as I understand, the British monarchy has been based upon illicit extramarital affairs since time immemorial.
Yeah,
it's
sure.
What they do.
That's what they do.
It's like having to go to Scouser for stealing hubcaps. What is your point?
No, no. Well, the point is that we don't talk about it with the Queen, do we? But it's probably true with the Queen.
It's true with all of them. I wouldn't have any expectations they'd do anything otherwise.
I think it's true with the upper class in general. The upper class combine, at least historically, of course, it gets bred out, but high intelligence and basically dark triad traits. And so they're more likely to do things like that. And so we shouldn't be shocked by it at all. But I think
people in the comments are saying that also that William was an unfaithful as well.
Mm. Yeah, that's correct.
It's just something that, if you're sort of rich and famous, you have more opportunity. I mean, quite a few people have affairs anyway, don't they? But I mean, it's not that uncommon.
1 in 5, I believe.
1 in 5, what, of married people?
Of married couple, yeah.
The man.
You'd need to be married to have an affair, wouldn't you?
Oh, exactly. Normally the man. This is true. But we can't talk about it with Queenie. But now it is being talked about. She's been dead for 4 years. She died actually just before I came on live to do the Jolly Heretic. Didn't she, Lipton? I was interviewing Virginia. Sorry.
But isn't it hiding in plain sight? So, for example, you're a bit diffident about talking about what the Queen might have got up to, whereas Prince Charles was boffing horsey face in plain sight.
This is true. And it's quite dangerous to think if he has an affair now. If you think about like the difference in beauty between Princess Diana and Camilla Parker Bowles, then if that carries on, who is it next?
Yeah, please don't take this the wrong way, but I would much rather have an amorous encounter with you rather than Camilla.
Right, exactly, and I understand why you would, because I'm a gentle and giving lover. But it's
also you don't look like a horse.
No, but then if you think how much uglier Camilla is than Diana, then like where does he go next? Like Anne Widdecombe? I mean, like
hey, Lipton, defend your woman.
We like Anne Widdecombe.
Isn't ugly.
No, I do like Anne Widdecombe. I do. I have her autobiography in my upstairs loo.
All about the bass, about the bass.
Strictly Anne, it's called.
Strictly.
But sorry, where were we? Yes, basically Prince Charles, King Charles, I'm sorry, the King, he's ballsed up. He's ballsed up badly. He's misread the room even more than his mother did when Diana died. Like, we didn't used to bother with things like St. George's Day. There was some passion, there was some Stages of the Cross thing in London. Yesterday or Good Friday, was it? And we didn't used to bother with that. That didn't happen. That happened in the Philippines or somewhere. And we're so concerned that we're losing it, that we're losing our control. We've become like the Scottish. So we have a need to assert ourselves and be nationalistic. In the 1990s, we didn't celebrate St. George's Day.
I think that was a mistake, wasn't it? I mean, I think once a people like forgets its traditions or the reason why it performs rituals and the things that hold itself together as a people and a country, like this is a problem. So, yeah, I mean, I agree there's a slightly reactive aspect to maybe even some people becoming Christian if they were brought up as liberal atheists or de facto kind of liberals. Like, It sort of makes sense. I think it's also happening in France in response to Islam there. Like a lot of young people are converting to Catholicism or, you know, reigniting their faith if they were baptized. So it's like a rearguard action, isn't it? I get it. I really do. Like, I think in the 90s, people somehow could afford to be ironic. And like, if you think about British comedy, it was like kind of, we had the confidence to sort of make jokes about ourselves and mock ourselves. And there was some fantastic comedy, but that only works if you've still got a residually homogenous population who can have that kind of reflexivity about themselves. And now we don't, because we're really, really fragmented and half of the white people are insane, unfortunately.
Yeah. Yeah. The fun isn't there. The fun isn't there. Like I'd love to go back in time, even to 2016 when My Facebook wall was composed of people of different opinions from mine, and that was okay, and that was fine, and they saw me being right wing or whatever as just a kind of harmless eccentricity, and now since the referendum, Lipton, yes.
Do you know what I was? Well, it's not a what; it's a person. Some time ago, I was saying, I remember back in the 2010s when I was in high school, when Satoshi Kanazawa was really popular. Back then, people could read eccentric writers and they would write in Psychology Today. But Satoshi Kanazawa, he still works, but he's not popular again.
No, well, he wrote something. He argued that black women are less attractive.
And not pretty, yes, yes.
Yeah, and then they got very cross with him. But he'd been arguing all kinds of base things for years, and it was absolutely fine. And
exactly.
Yeah,
interestingly, there is this paper from 2026, a recent paper, showing the subjective gradings of students based on how they look. And the rating said that the students from Africa, they were not deemed to be attractive. And on dating sites, people don't consider black women to be overly pretty. So it's not wrong.
No, but that was the shift, though, wasn't it? That was the shift, that life was now a battle and a war. This was all that was a shift, that something happened in the culture, that nothing's more important than not
a black woman.
People. Yeah, nothing's more important than not offending people. And so that was it. And even he was, I mean, let's face it, he was saying that the least attractive men are East Asian men, i.e. him. and he was perfectly fine with that. But that was the shift. That was the time, about 10 years ago, in Finland, yes, as well, I guess. But that was when it shifted. And I just, it pains me. Facebook was such good fun. And when it didn't matter, one of my best friends at university was a leading member of Young Labour, and I lived next door to her in my first year in college, and I was involved in the Young Conservatives, and that was fine. And now I hear the university, you're very careful who you talk to. You're very careful who you talk to about anything, until you know what they think, and only then do you.
Who is at Cambridge or Oxford, I can't remember, she told me that at parties, people carry a recording device or record on their phone and then ask, like, difficult questions to try to record people, you know, saying things they shouldn't say. I mean, it's not really going to encourage an environment of critical thinking and or drinking, is it, if people are constantly, like, recording you, like little Stasi's agents, in case you engage in wrong speak. It's terrible. I mean, the good thing about the 90s was that, like, lots of people were on drugs and drinking all the time, and there were no cameras, sort of thing. Do you know what I mean? So
all I can say is it's a good job no one's recording us.
Exactly.
Oh, no.
Nobody.
That's sorry. Who told you that, Nina?
Oh, a young woman at Cambridge or Oxford. I can't remember. But she's, you know, someone who is there now, like someone who is in their late teens, early 20s. So she was saying that basically, like, people who are like progressives are trying to catch people out of parties by having the recorder on in their phone and then asking, oh, do you think trans women are women or whatever at a party, as if it's like a normal conversation, so that they can, you know, get evidence that someone is engaging in wrong think.
And then ruin their lives or try to ruin their lives. I mean, that's despicable. That's absolutely vile. Terrible.
But I mean, but this is social media is like this too, right? It's like screenshots. Oh, you said this. This is the only way we can interpret it. There are no jokes anymore. You know, you meant this. There is no context. It's like you're an evil person. I mean, people do this to me all the time.
No, I know a chap who had to, because of tweets that he made unwisely, you know, based tweets when he was 18 or 19 at university, has had to legally change his name.
Wow.
Such that he can, you know, get a job. That's it. And that's the pressure they're under. So no wonder they don't want to drink. I mean, if you drink, you let your guard down, and then you could actually.
Did you used to be called Fred Button?
That would have been the way forward, wouldn't it? That would have been. Oh, it's like being at school, Paul, with you. It's like being back at school. Oh, Edward Chocolate Button went to Sutton and bought some mutton.
That's quite...
Yes, my name rhymes with quite a few things.
Seriously, though, I think the lack of mutton and its availability in the UK is an issue. It's much better than lamb, but you can never buy it.
I had it yesterday. In Finland, because they don't farm sheep much here, so lamb is very expensive. So they do eat mutton. It's called karitse.
It's quite rare in the US, unless you go to an ethnic area. The Americans find it too, you know, strong flavoured.
No, it's lovely. It's lovely.
It's gorgeous.
It's popular in Jamaica.
Yeah. I like goat curry as well, Lipton. There's a place in Manchester I used to go to all the time.
Goat was nice. I was at a Jamaican restaurant in Birmingham, in Handsworth, in Birmingham, and I had...
Jamaicans, we know how to cook good food.
Except one time, Lipton, I got my takeaway and I found a huge piece of marigold glove in the middle. Is that a traditional Jamaican addition?
No. Nina, will you be... Ed, I really like Nina.
Good.
Oh, here we go.
We did predict this.
Nina.
Three quarters of the way through, Nina. The moves.
I want Nina to read my book. She might not like it.
Will you read my book?
Go on.
You can pay me for my editing services.
Yes.
Oh, go on, edit for me. Go on.
If he did pay you for that, you'd just say what I said, which is make it more funny.
He's like a funny guy. You're a funny chap. No,
exactly.
No, this computer is sensitive, so I can't be too funny.
No, you can't be. Sorry.
No, well, why can't you make it funnier?
It's too sensitive.
No,
oh, okay.
It's not. It's you talking about all the studies about black people and stuff, right? And like that's interesting. And you could give all kinds of personal examples because you're from Jamaica. And then it would be a more interesting book. That's what I'm suggesting that you do. That was my kindly critique. Anyway, Clapham riots. So going back to some of the stuff we were talking about earlier, another thing I can't understand is how like in Finland, in Oulu, where I live a couple of years ago, there was a Somali and he was getting all aggressive in a pub in a place called, I forget the suburb, but some suburb of Oulu, at a Toyota. And so the police were called and he went in, he was in this pub and he was holding an axe. And so the police just shot him dead. No messing about, they just went to the pub, shot him dead. End of issue. And in Finland, they'll take stealing very seriously. And you know they will call the police, and you will be arrested. And that's what happens if you steal things here. Like the police will come. The police will come if your neighbours are being noisy. I mean, the police will come round and fine them €500 on the spot for making a lot of noise after 10 o'clock at night. That's how it works here. One time, I was a chap. I don't know if he's watching, a friend of mine, but we were on his balcony. And this drunk guy came along and tried to climb on the balcony. And so we rang the police and they came and they just dragged him away. That's how they work here. The police come for crime. I don't live in England. I don't understand this. A guy who worked for Waitrose, who tried to stop someone stealing stuff, was sacked for last week for that. And the police just don't come if there's crime. Except, of course, if it's hurty words and tweets and Andrew Bridgen, as we've discussed. Mm-hmm. I cannot understand how you people can live like this. Perhaps Nina more than Paul. I don't know how it works in Wales. But how is this? How has this happened? Why don't the police come if there's crime?
Well, it's a good question, isn't it? I mean, I think obviously it's easier to arrest people for tweets. I think there's a lot of worry about inflaming community tensions, which, you know, we saw with the rape gangs. This has been going on for decades. I think in the wake of the English riots of 2011, if you remember, which were triggered by the killing of Mark Duggan, kicked off in Tottenham and then spread to various towns and cities. And if you recall, people went to prison for Facebook posts that were like, one guy set up a joke event page for a riot in his town, and he went to prison for that. People went to prison for stealing water. They do periodically crack down, but I think with this latest Clapham thing, this sort of steaming or whatever it's called, where you kind of go as a mob into a shop and, I don't know, disrupt things and steal things and so on. I mean, the people are also filming this for social media. It's not a particularly new thing. Do you remember various things before? There was like this horrible trend where people would go and slap random strangers and film it. That kind of thing. That was, I don't know, 15 years ago or something.
That's how Ed and I met.
That's your sort of mating ritual, isn't it? Sort of, anyway. But I think there is just this kind of, the second order thinking is always like, well, we don't want to do anything that will kick something off, right? So it's like, you know, we don't want to be racist and say there are Pakistani rape gangs. And also the police and the councillors are sort of in on it. So everyone's kind of complicit, because then there'll be, right, race riots, right? And we don't want to tell young black kids off, because then there'll be race riots. And we don't, you know, so the only people they can arrest are sort of like white middle class people who won't react violently.
Well, Nina, I've forgotten the name of the woman, but there was a black comedian on, I think it must have been LBC, which I never watch or listen to, but I saw it on YouTube. And she was saying the tired old line, it was racist to point out that the Clapham Massive tended to be black almost exclusively from what I saw. And she compared it to knife crime and said other races have knife crime. It's racist to point out. And it's this thing on the left where they deliberately pretend they've no longer understood the mathematical concept of proportionality. And we can all be more PC than anything, whilst meanwhile, without sounding like, you know, emotive, black mothers bury black kids who've been stabbed disproportionately.
Really?
So you either confront the issue or more black kids die.
This idea
that it's doing anyone any favours is ridiculous.
I mean, Steve Saylor pointed out, sorry, one sec, Lipton, like the Black Lives Matter actually resulted in the deaths of more black people. So if your goal in BLM as a white ally or whatever was to save black lives, you manifestly failed in your mission, because more black people died as a consequence of BLM. And then restricting the sort of police behaviour and abolish the police and all that actually negatively affects poor black people way more than it affects any other group, right? So the consequences of these like virtuous positions are actually extremely negative for the very people that they pretend that they're trying to help. Yeah,
that's why they're called
fatherlessness. Fatherlessness in black communities is really high, right? So how many of the kids in the Clapham thing are like from single parent?
Well, that's what made me laugh, because one of the commentators said their parents should get control of them, and that would beg the question: how do they find their parents?
Right. Sorry.
There's a misapprehension. There are two parents at home looking after these kids, which there isn't, and hence they're out on the streets.
Lipton, were you going to say something?
No, I was about to say that this issue is a bit controversial and contentious, because we don't know how to solve it. The data on black crime, that data has been quite negative for a long time now. After slavery was abolished in the US, people started to study black crime, and the data we have from as early as the 19th century show some seriously strange crime rates for blacks, even those who were educated. And I'm talking about the 19th century.
Richard Lynn looked at that, didn't he? That if you control for education, it's still higher. Even if you control for the kind of variables that should predict that it's still higher. I mean, I had an interesting experience it would have been about March 2004, and I ended up, some friends, left-wing friends, from Durham University that were living together in the East End, and one of them was a socials worker, support worker, and she said, Ed, you know how you're really racist? I said, okay, if you say so. Do you want to come and spend the day with me and these black children that I'm looking after? And I said, all right, I've got nothing to do today. It's Sunday. Fine. So off we go. And it turned out that there was a 42-year-old grandmother of a child of like eight or something. And then there was the grandson, and the mother of the grandson, the daughter of the grandmother, was in jail. And so these two black boys, this little black girl of about two, and we took them out, and it was all fine, and no father, obviously, at all. And then I was like teaching this little girl, Tuti, her name was, in teaching in Finnish, and then one of the grandson, who the grandmother was not particularly nice to, she said, "Oh, you're just like your father. He's just like his father," she said to me, and then ran off. And we had to go and find him and whatever, and it was very difficult and dangerous. And then we eventually got him, found him, and took him back. And my friend had to explain to the grandmother what had happened, which is that this boy had run away. And then she went absolutely mad and in front of us, threw him across the stairs and took her shoe off and just started beating him on his backside. I'm the only man here. Like, should I stop this? Should I intervene? Like, what am I supposed to do? And eventually she calmed down, and she was telling me, "This is how we do things in Jamaica." Even though I think
thank God, Ed, I honestly thought you were going to say at the end of the story that you joined in. You took your shoe off.
Why would I do that?
Don't go there.
No, I had to give a report. I had to give an official report as to what I'd seen. And the boy was then taken into care.
Yeah, but didn't we see Lipton? His young, was it niece or nephew? And off camera, we heard a big wallop.
No, yeah, he wasn't eating. He was just making noise.
We heard you hit a kid with a frying pan, Lipton. It was like Tom and Jerry.
Yeah, you were saying that they were badly behaved, Lipton.
Yeah, and we heard this big noise and a sudden silence.
It's the Jamaican way.
I think you're being racist for judging it.
Sorry, I do apologise to anyone out there. I do apologise for my racism, but that was just like a one-off experience of the. I'd never seen anyone hit so hard as this child, and she went on and on hitting him, and my friend was like in tears, and I just couldn't believe it. And I, like, to what extent is this what goes on? I mean, it was appalling, absolutely appalling. Just beat him senseless like that, this poor boy. And all he'd done is run away. He'd probably done that to get attention. He'd done that because he doesn't get attention from the grandmother, because grandma's horrible to him.
I don't know. I'm confused now, because I think if more of that had gone on, that it would have been less of the Clapham Massive running around in the shops.
Weirdly, that is consistent with the data, Paul. That is consistent with that is. I hate to say it, but that is consistent with the data on this. But crime has to be seen to be dealt with. And this idea that you stand there and you film them, we're filming them and we're going to go there later and have a chat. No, like, we need you to do something now.
It was New York in the 80s, wasn't it? They called it the broken window syndrome. Was it Giuliani at the time said, if you mend the broken window, you scrub off the graffiti and you take care of minor crime. And I was in New York for part of that period, and it changed really quickly for the better. So it's not irredeemable. I think you get into this mind doom loop where nothing can be made better. I think a few small tweaks, like suing the police for neglect or not doing their job, sacking them if they don't do the basics. You know, that stabbing in Nottingham, I was reading about the whole litany of institutional errors. There was a policewoman read the report on the guy who did the stabbing. He'd attacked a policeman. She saw on the report they had an outstanding warrant, and she let him go. She should be sacked and prosecuted for misconduct. She won't be. And he went on and killed three people.
Yeah. There was a whole list of them. There was a whole Connor Kone or something, the surname is, isn't it? This black guy from...
Lipton, every single week, you and I go, consequences, consequences. And that's what it needs. If there were consequences, things would change.
I would imagine that taking away corporal punishment in schools was probably a mistake. That's, you know, that's the impression I get. Like that then suddenly you're like, there was corporal punishment at my primary school, but it was illegal. but had only just been made illegal. So the teachers hadn't quite got the message yet.
Well, you had to ask for it.
No. I remember there was some woman that came in, and I remember her smacking this boy called Chirag and this girl called Barry. And she was, I think she was Scottish or something. And so she, I think it was still legal there until 1992. In England, it was banned in 86. But it's
I think
it was whole...
Scotland. Vegetables were made illegal in 1950.
Yes, that's well known. But there's no, you have no order. There's no, it's just I don't know, in some schools they don't even, the children can barely read now. And I was talking to this teacher.
Do you mean schools, universities? Know what Nina's experience was?
What?
I'm saying not bloody schools, people can't read, universities.
Well, there were a surprising number of people, even when I was a student in 97 and went to university, who didn't particularly like reading, even though they'd signed up to study philosophy and literature. And I used to be very annoyed with them. And then I'd get told off by my tutors for being annoyed at the other students because they were saying I wasn't being very nice. And I said, well, they shouldn't be in university if they don't want to be here and do the reading. I was very annoying, but I was right. Do you know what I mean? I thought it was an honour. I went to university for free in 1997. It was still free. It's the last year it was free. But you know what I mean? It was like I wanted to read and study. And who were these bloody lame asses who were like, you know, I'm just here to do amateur dramatics and I don't like reading. Anyway, the point is we should bring back capital punishment.
Yes. No, I think we can. What kind of society does
Nina, I think you're... Coca-Cola has had its full effect.
You know, this is genuinely Coca-Cola. I don't drink alcohol.
Yeah, I'm not doubting it. I'm questioning what's in it.
I wish I could drink alcohol, but I can't because my Irish alcoholic genes are so pronounced that I'm a terrible alcoholic, so I can't drink at all.
It's Coca-Cola with sort of a third of Pimm's.
But Nina, can you explain to me what the Irish alcoholic genes? I thought my Irish alcoholic genes are such that I can tolerate alcohol so highly.
No,
I don't realise I'm an alcoholic.
There's actually some interesting evidence that despite our association with Irishness and alcohol, it arrived there much later in evolutionary terms. So Irish people have some of the adaptation that the other Northern Europeans, because obviously there are two ways of dealing with dirty water, one of which is to boil it, which is a sort of Eastern way, and the other of which is to ferment it, right, which is the European way. But perhaps the Irish were a bit slow to catch on, so we've got some of the adaptation, but not all of it, which is why there are so many Irish alcoholics.
Perhaps the Irish were a bit slow to catch on.
No, but Nina, aren't they two different things? I mean, I'm generally interested in this scientific question, Ed, and I'll be asking for your expert opinion in a second. Alcoholism's not the same as alcoholic tolerance.
Well, you tell me.
No, for example, you can tolerate a lot of alcohol potentially, but then not being able to stop yourself is a separate question.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, what can we say about it?
He says defensively.
No, I think
the two things are sort of are combined. A person that becomes drunk easily is intolerant of alcohol, and the person that becomes addicted to alcohol easily is kind of intolerant of it.
Right, but what about the person? My experience of Irish people is we can drink an awful lot more than most people.
In evolutionary terms, if you can deal, the water's dirty, so you have to be able to deal with alcohol. If you can't deal with alcohol, either because you become drunk easily or because you become addicted to it and you become violent, you'll be selected out.
Right, but is your knowledge of the data, my suspicion is that the Irish are actually better at handling alcohol in terms of just biologically. The question of whether they have a predisposition to become an alcoholic, I'd argue, is more psychological. One's biological capability of processing it through your kidneys and having the requisite enzymes that are missing in the Far East, for example, in some people.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I'll tell you what, I'll look into this for next week because there was a very interesting study by a guy called Marusik, and he looked at the data on why there's a J curve of alcoholism going from Finland all the way through the Baltic states down into Slovenia. And the argument was that a certain kind of farming got there late and they had slash and burn farming for longer and therefore they didn't have alcohol for as long and therefore they weren't adapted to it. And therefore alcoholism among Finno-Ugric peoples is associated with alcohol among them is associated with becoming an alcoholic and also committing suicide. The writer, Andre Marusik, the academic, eventually committed suicide at the age of 40. I don't know. You know, I'll look into that for next week. Right, I'm going to round up now. So I'd like to thank Nina for coming on. It was an absolute pleasure and a delight. And I'd like to thank you all for watching. And we will see you all next week. And tally-ho. And goodbye.
Goodbye.